Vous écoutez en balado-diffusion le colloque Civic Freedom in an Age of Diversity, James Tully's Public Philosophy, présenté par le groupe de recherche sur les sociétés plurinationales. 14e épisode, conférence de Mike Murphy, Self-Determination, a Basic Human Right and a Basic Human Need.
Here today, I'd like to begin by thanking the organizers for putting together this wonderful celebration of Jim's work. Jim has been a profound influence on my own thinking over the years. I can hardly think of anything I've ever written that didn't have his fingerprints on it somewhere in some place. Jim, in addition, has also been a tremendous source of support at every stage of my career. So I'm really pleased to be invited and to have the opportunity to give a little bit back by I hope honoring Jim's work and contributions with a paper. Now the paper that I have today is partly about Jim's work. It's also partly about being inspired by Jim's work and applying his insights in some very different fields of inquiry. And I should. Apologize in advance here because I'm going to bring the discussion well outside the bounds of political theory into the mysterious realms of social epidemiology and psychology. This represents a very dramatic departure from my own usual research program, which is much more sort of a normative political theory. But it's very much in the spirit of this applied political theory, which Jim so enthusiastically endorses, so I'm sorry, but I'm not that sorry. So. The title of my paper hosts two very different sorts of claims. The first is that self-determination is a fundamental human right to which indigenous peoples, like all other peoples, are entitled as a basic requirement of justice. Now, Jim has defended this claim with great force and eloquence in his own work, and I won't attempt to add anything to that account here. I'm going to focus instead on the second kind of claim, which can also be found in Jim's work. It plays a slightly less prominent role, and for this reason, I think it's taken up has attracted a lot less attention. But it's equally important, I think. The claim is that self-determination is a basic human need to which all peoples, indigenous and non-indigenous alike, can lay claim to as a fundamental component of their well-being. Now, Jim articulates this connection in the language of recognition, and it goes something like this: when Indigenous peoples are denied recognition of their identities as peoples with the right to self-determination, or what is worse, when their identities and modes of self-governance are denigrated and suppressed, this not only constitutes an injustice, it also serves, and here I quote from Jim directly, to undermine the self-respect and hence the very abilities of the people concerned, not only to resist these injustices, but also to act effectively even if they opt to assimilate. This causes the well-known pathologies of oppression, marginalization, and assimilation. These are lack of self-respect and self-esteem, alienation, transgenerational poverty, substance abuse, unemployment, the destruction of communities, high levels of suicide, and the like. Now, this fairly simple but powerful claim that self-determination is in some essential way connected to the health and vitality of Indigenous individuals and communities, and conversely, that the denial or impairment of self-determination is fundamentally corrosive of physical and mental well-being, is, I think, widely shared amongst commentators on Indigenous rights and decolonization, and also in the literature on Indigenous health. Now, the question that I've been kind of preoccupied with over the last 12 to 18 months, and it's a question that I'll spend the rest of my time talking about, is what is it about self-determination or its absence that carries such apparently significant consequences for Indigenous health? Now, one possible explanation is that communities that lack self-determination, and communities in particular which lack control over the administration and delivery of their own health services, enjoy poorer services, leading to poorer health outcomes. Now, there's in fact a small amount of research evidence which suggests that this indeed is the case in the communities that take over control of the administration and delivery of their own health services, which is a sort of small form of self-determination, actually get better services and enjoy better health. Okay, but that's really a purely kind of instrumental kind of argument, instrumental kind of claim. It's not really, it's very different, I think, from the kind of argument that Jim and others seem to be making. His argument, if I read it correctly, is that self-determination and its appropriate recognition by others is inherently important because of its connection to individual freedom and self-esteem. To undermine self-determination is therefore to undermine this foundation of freedom and self-respect of individuals, and it is this deficit in freedom and self-respect that help explains the ongoing challenges in Indigenous health. Okay, now this still leaves us with the question, how? How does this deficit in freedom and self-respect get under the skin, so to speak, to influence physical and mental health outcomes? To help answer this question, and again, I don't claim to have answered this question in anything near complete form. Most of this research is very preliminary and very suggestive, so what I'm going to try to do is suggest some possible connections based on my reading of recent research in the fields of social epidemiology and social psychology. And the accounts I'm going to present are going to be very boiled down and simplified based on the reading of a non-expert, so please bear with me. So I begin with the research conducted by Michael Marmot and his colleagues on the social determinants of health inequalities. And one of the most significant conclusions to emerge from this research, and it comes out of Marmot's research, but also from a wide variety of others who followed in the path, is that health inequalities are strongly correlated with social and economic status. Specifically, people who enjoy higher socioeconomic status generally enjoy better health outcomes, while people who enjoy lower socioeconomic status generally enjoy poorer health. A second key finding, and this is the one that caught my attention, is that one of the key explanatory links between health and status is autonomy, the degree of control people feel they have over their lives. People with greater perceived control over their lives tend to be healthier, while those with lower perceived control tend to be less healthy. Decreased life control or decreased autonomy contributes to negative health outcomes in at least two different ways. First of all, through the production of sustained chronic and long-term stress. Now, normal stress is a normal part of everyday life. It's not unhealthy. What is unhealthy is chronic, sustained, and long-term stress, which operates through various biological pathways, which I'm totally unqualified to talk about in detail. But the very simplified version is what this produces is an accelerated aging of the organ systems, something like that. Okay, so chronic stress is associated with this lack of autonomy, lack of control that produces. That's one mechanism for these that produces the one biological pathway. Second, stress also produces coping behaviors such as smoking, alcohol consumption, poor diet, and physical activity. So these are the two sort of main pathways that are identified in the literature. Now, this link between perceived control and health, or perceived autonomy and health, has been established in relation to a wide variety of health afflictions, including heart, lung, and kidney disease, diabetes, mental illness, suicide, and deaths resulting from accidents, and violence, the very same afflictions that are now the leading causes of morbidity and mortality in Indigenous communities worldwide. Now, Marmot's research began with a focus on health in the workplace. It was a study, a 20-year study of health in the British civil service, but it's since been expanded by himself and others to cover a number of other countries, including the health collapse in former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, and in a number of other life domains. And the basic message that emerges is always the same. Autonomy, or the capability to lead the lives we most want to lead, is essential to our health, or at least it's one essential component of health. Okay, that's all for the social epidemiology research. A nearly identical message emerges from the research conducted by Richard Ryan and Edward Dacey in the field of social psychology. Ryan and Dacey are the originators of what's called self-determination theory. I was kind of amazed when I came across this this term, that because, again, I'll get to the reason for that later. This is an empirically derived theory of human development and well-being that identifies three basic psychological needs that are universally and cross-culturally required for humans to thrive. First and foremost is the need for autonomy. Okay, to live autonomously, and here they have a slightly different definition than the one you see in the social epidemiological literature. To live autonomously is to live a life that is self-endorsed, a life that accords with one's genuine values and preferences. The opposite of autonomy is not independence, but heteronomy. Okay, the feeling that one's life is being restricted, controlled, or dictated by forces or persons or things that one does not freely or genuinely endorse. Second is the basic need for relatedness, which really refers to the need for a sense of belonging to and a sense of importance to a larger social order or social grouping. Third is the basic need for competence, which manifests itself through the mastery of certain skills or techniques that enable us to operate more effectively in the world and to achieve our desired ends in life. Now, like the research in social epidemiology, self-determination theory has been empirically tested in a wide variety of social environments, including educational settings, employment settings, healthcare settings, elder care settings, and in the domain of intrafamiliar relations. And what all of these studies reveal is that when any of these basic needs, and particularly the need for autonomy, when any of these basic needs are not met, the result is psychological ill health in the form of things like depression, anxiety, reduced self-esteem, feelings of hopelessness and passivity, and social dysfunction. Okay, so the message that emerges from both of these research programs, at least as I read them, is that when people lack autonomy, when rather than feeling in control of their own lives, people instead feel that they are being controlled or dominated by others or by their social, economic, or political circumstances, their mental and physical health tends to deteriorate. And for those who feel the least autonomous, the outcomes are generally the worst. Now, a second key message that emerges from this research is that autonomy, and you see this in both the psychology research and in the epidemiological research, is that autonomy is closely connected with self-esteem, and both are prerequisites for good physical and psychological health. So autonomy is closely linked with self-esteem. This is a quote from Michael Marmot. Autonomy is closely linked with self-esteem and the earning of respect. Both are basic and linked. Low levels of autonomy and low levels of self-esteem are likely to be related to worse health. Now, strangely enough, neither of these literatures, I just received a score of 5 out of 10 on my presentation so far, so I'm going to have to bump up the quality. Neither of these literatures have had much to say, in fact, almost nothing to say about the distinctly political dimensions of autonomy. So when I came across self-determination theory, I was like, well, obviously they're going to be talking here a lot about politics, but it's really only mentioned as a kind of footnote. They say, you know, mainly they're talking about other kinds of social settings, and then they kind of say, well, you know, obviously political determinants of autonomy are quite important. They also sort of gesture towards the fact that autonomy has both collective and individual dimensions, but they don't really talk about the politics of it. Nobody so far, I think very few people, if any, have directly applied this to the realm of politics. I only came across one study. Nobody, as far as I can tell, has tried to apply this in the domain of collective ideas of autonomy and the relationship between collective autonomy and individual autonomy. Okay, so this is where I bring Jim's work back into the conversation. And Jim is not the only one who's relevant. There's been lots of people who have made this connection between collective autonomy and individual autonomy. And, you know, I see many of them sitting in this room right here. Because Jim helps us understand the interdependence that exists between individual and collective expressions of autonomy and how this interdependence potentially connects up with the findings of the social epidemiologists and the social psych and the self-determination theory. So there's a couple of important things or important connections that Jim's work helps us see more clearly, and I'll just very roughly sketch these out. First of all, when indigenous peoples are denied self-determination, they're denied several kinds of freedom. In the first sense, they're deprived of a kind of communal freedom. To borrow some of the language of Charles Taylor, this is the freedom whose nature requires that it be sought in common. So the idea of coming together as a collective to constitute yourself as a political community and to rule yourself as a political community distinct from others, that's that kind of collective freedom. Okay, this also involves the restriction of the rights of individuals to act within, to deliberate within, to participate within, to dissent from those collective institutions through which that community expresses its collective self-determination. Third, it also infringes upon the freedom of people to negotiate their relationships with others freely self-determining peoples, to negotiate those relationships and to periodically renegotiate those relationships. Now, predictably, when people are denied these kinds of freedoms and are instead subjected to control and domination by others, they experience feelings such as frustration, anger, resentment, a profound sense of injustice, but also feelings of powerlessness, hopelessness, and sometimes despair, all of which have been linked to chronic stress, and all of which have been linked empirically with degraded levels of physical and mental health. Now, a second thing Jim draws our attention to is the manner in which individuals construct their sense of identity and their sense of self-esteem, partly in relation to their membership and their sense of belonging to a wider community, such as an indigenous people or a nation. And when these communities are demeaned, denigrated, or even actively suppressed, that sense of identity and self-respect can itself easily be undermined. Now, again, this is an especially important insight in the context of the current discussion because there's been an abundance of empirical research that shows how threats to status and self-esteem, particularly in situations where people feel a low degree of control, are one of the most powerful health-compromising sources of stress. Okay, now looking very quickly now through the lens of self-determination theory, Jim's work provides, I think, a compelling account of how indigenous peoples who are denied their right to self-determination will experience the terms under which they are governed, not autonomously, but heteronomously. Okay, that is, as alien and unwanted and as largely inconsistent with their own genuine values and preferences. Living under alien and unchosen forms of government also, I think, makes it more difficult for communities to work together to shape and sustain themselves in such a way that broadly reflects their distinctive identities, traditions, cultures, languages, etc. And that, in turn, frustrates potentially the basic need for this sense of belonging and this sense of competence within a particular kind of community, not just any community, but the community that is yours. Okay, so for all of these reasons, we might expect to see a clear connection, and I'm going to end very quickly, between the denial of self-determination and a deterioration of indigenous mental health, okay, and better health outcomes in communities where these basic needs are met. And the closest thing we have to empirical confirmation of this is a remarkable study conducted by Michael Chandler and Christopher Lalonde on suicide amongst indigenous youth in British Columbia. So what this researcher said is, he said, if you look at province-wide at the youth suicide statistics, it looks like, you know, they're skyrocketing in comparison with non-Indigenous peoples. But if you look at the community level, you get a very different picture. What they show is that communities, and they have a series of indicators for measuring this, communities which have made a significant degree of headway in regaining local control over their local self-government, and which have also made significant headway in revitalizing their traditions and cultures, and which have advanced their land claims, have rates of suicide that approach zero. Communities that have not made headway on these indicators have rates of suicide that are up to 200, 300, 400 times the average. So it seems to me that there's various ways of interpreting that evidence, but one way is by saying that communities that have satisfied their basic needs of their members for autonomy, connectedness, and competence are doing better. Well, that's at least one contributing factor to the improvement of health in communities that are unable to do this, or that are prevented from doing this, are suffering negative mental health consequences. Okay, now I have a section in here where I qualify this by saying that there's many factors that are determine the health of any given community, and I'm not saying that this one is the key. It may not even be relevant at all. This is not based on empirical research, but what I've tried to show here is that, again, there's a huge amount of research in psychology, social epidemiology, that shows a very powerful connection between individual autonomy and health outcomes. Okay, that's been empirically not proven, but the correlations are compelling. Jim's work and the work of others shows us that collective autonomy, individual autonomy and collective autonomy are highly interdependent. So if we put these two messages together, it seems to me that self-determination or the lack of self-determination must have at least some bearing on Indigenous physical and mental health outcomes. Okay, so very, very quickly, I think Jim's work on the struggles of Indigenous peoples for and of self-determination will stand as one of his most significant and enduring contributions to the theory and practice of diversity recognition, both in Canada and internationally. What I've tried to do here today is to show that the reach of Jim's work extends well beyond the sphere of abstract theory to speak directly to some of the most fundamental preconditions of freedom and well-being in a diverse democracy. And in so doing, it really drives home the message, for me at least, that a truly just society must do its utmost to ensure that these conditions are enjoyed equally by all of its constituent peoples, Indigenous and non-Indigenous alike. Thank you.